Today at Reader's Corner, J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The 2016 presidential election and its aftermath have raised new questions about our nation's so-called cultural divide. What does that divide mean for Americans who are struggling? In his bestseller, Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance tells us in plain language what it was like to be raised in a family of proud, poor, and loving yet broken hillbillies. His recollections of growing up in Middleton, Ohio, and Jackson, Kentucky, in a home marred by substance abuse and poverty, offer a glimpse of the trauma suffered by many children in our growing class of poor Americans. Today, we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with J.D. Vance. He is a veteran who served with the Marines in Iraq, a graduate of Ohio State University and Yale Law School, a contributor to the National Review and the New York Times, and a principal at a leading Silicon Valley investment firm. Since we aired the show, J.D. Vance wrote a New York Times op-ed piece announcing his plan to move back to Middleton, Ohio, where he hopes to join others in building viable businesses and civic institutions. Mr. Vance himself just founded an organization to combat Ohio's opioid epidemic. We wish him well in his new life of dedication to his hometown and his state of Ohio. J.D. Vance, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
Well, J.D., as I was telling you before we started the interview here, having served as president of Eastern Kentucky University, I've been around your region there quite a bit, and I remember the first time I met the governor of Kentucky, he pulled me aside and he said, "Bob, I want you to know that they didn't put Eastern Kentucky University in Eastern Kentucky." And I had to think about that for a minute, got my map out, and sure enough, looks to me like Richmond, Kentucky is in central Kentucky. So maybe we ought to start by your giving our listeners an idea of what is Eastern Kentucky as opposed to the rest of Kentucky.
Sure. So first you have to understand that the state is sort of divided between east and west. And in the east you have the Appalachian Mountains. So the folks there, I think, really strongly identify with the land, with mountain culture. They call themselves hill people, mountain people. And among insiders, sometimes people even call themselves hillbillies, which is, of course, the title of my book. And, you know, the thing about mountain culture is that it's a little bit more hardscrabble, a little bit more attached to the land, a little bit more identified with poverty and a history of you know, frankly, people who have struggled quite a bit. So it hasn't been an easy life, but folks who live there are very proud of where they came from, and I think proud of the fact that that hard life has developed some pretty tough character traits.
Now, these are descendants of the Scots-Irish who were leaving England, really trying to find a place where people would leave them alone to begin with, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So if you just look at the ethnic identification of Eastern Kentucky, but also, you know, frankly, a lot of areas along the Appalachian Mountains, West Virginia, Eastern Tennessee, and so forth, the Scots-Irish are, in almost every single county, the largest ethnicity present. And I think that says something, obviously, one, about the homogeneity of the region. You know, it's diverse in its own way, but it does have a really strong Scots-Irish population. But it's also, you know, an area where I think that Scots-Irish history and heritage informs the broader culture. And so we talk a lot about family loyalty and sometimes even family violence. And I think if you go back in time, that didn't start in Eastern Kentucky. A lot of times it started before these folks even left their homeland to begin with.
Now, you had somewhat of a bifurcated childhood because, on the one hand, you would spend part of your time in Jackson and then the other part in Middleton, Ohio. Tell us about how that all comes about.
Sure. So there was a massive migration of mountain people to the industrial Midwest right after World War II. And so, you know, they were moving for pretty obvious reasons, for jobs, for higher wages. And so that migration brought my grandparents from Eastern Kentucky into southwestern Ohio, and that's where I spent most of my time, was in southwestern Ohio. Of course, it didn't feel that different from Jackson because a lot of the people who lived in my neighborhood, a lot of the people who lived in my community had also come from Eastern Kentucky in their own way. So there was this constant sense that we had, even though we lived in southwestern Ohio, there was the sense that in some ways Kentucky had just been transplanted from one part of the country to the other, And as kids, we even called it Middle Tucky because so many of the folks who lived there had Kentucky roots.
Well, the role of family plays the most important part of your book. You've dedicated this book to your grandparents, Mama and Papa. Tell us about them, who they were as a people, why they made such a formative difference in your life.
Sure, absolutely. So I should start that by saying that my grandparents were the people who really, have a lot of the credit for good or for bad for raising me, because I spent most of my formative years in their household. My mom and my dad in different ways struggled to play the role in my life that I think a lot of parents want and expect to play in their children's lives. So my grandparents really had to pick up the slack. And so, as I said, when my grandfather died, he was the best father that anybody could have asked for, because, that's really what he was to me up until he passed away. So they were in, I think, both cultural identification and in mindset, Eastern Kentucky people. They never lost their accents. They never lost their sense that they came from the hills of Jackson, Kentucky, and they were proud of it. But they also, I think it affected the way that they interacted with their communities. They were a little bit wary of outsiders in certain ways. And as my grandma said, she was from Breathitt County, where a woman wasn't fully dressed until she had her gun. So that's the sort of place that they came from, and I think they were very proud of it. But of course, it affected the way that they interacted with their communities and the way that they conducted their lives.
You point out in your book that the state, whether it's Kentucky, the federal government, we'll just call it the state doesn't really appreciate the role of the extended family and the role it can play in particular in raising kids. And you actually gave some examples of where you had to bend the truth a little bit just to make sure that you didn't wind up in some foster home where you wouldn't have the loving support of your grandparents.
Yeah, there was a domestic violence case, which I was the main victim, that involved my mom. And, it wasn't, looking back, I don't think a significant issue. It certainly was very significant at the time, but it did involve the Child Welfare Agency in our lives. And it was very clear, based on the way that the child welfare bureaucracy, the way that they interjected themselves into our lives, that they were trying to do good by us. They were trying to help us. But they also created a very, very difficult decision for me and my sister, which was that if we kept on talking and we kept on telling the truth about some of the things that were going on in our home, that we would be removed from that home. And consequently, we had to make a pretty tough decision. Were we going to tell these people the truth, or were we going to lie to them so that we could avoid foster care but continue to stay with our grandparents, who, like I said, were really picking up the slack in our family life? And I will say that from what I've read and what I've gleaned, that child welfare agencies are getting better about this. There is a recognition that they have to appreciate the role of this extended kinship of family. But they were pretty bad at it then, and I think they still have a lot of room to improve now.
So I'm reading your book, and by the time I get to the end of it, I think, how many houses did this guy live in from the time he entered school till he graduated from high school? Because it wasn't just about going back and forth from your mom's place to your grandparents' place. It was also moving to your dad's place. It was moving to your stepdad's places or your mom's boyfriend's places. Could you give a rough estimate of how many different homes as a child growing up you lived in?
Yeah, it would be hard to give a precise estimate without sitting down and counting them all out. But my best guess is around a dozen between the time that I was 6 and the time that I was 14, which is when I moved in with my grandma permanently. I think we probably had about a dozen homes that we lived in for, a month or two at least. And that may be undercounting it. It definitely, our lives were a pretty chaotic and unstable thing. And when people ask me, what I really most wish that I had in my childhood that I didn't have, I would definitely say that it was that stability. It was that sense that you were going to go to a house, you were going to stay there that night, and you were going to be there a year or two down the road. And until I moved in with my grandma full time, I really didn't have that. And that was something that definitely had its consequences.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, A Memoir of a Family and Culture in Crisis. And you give so much credit to your grandparents, as you should, and to others who stepped in and played a role in your life. Your uncle in California, who you kind of looked up to as a guy that you might want to be like. But on the other hand, when I read this book, I think, you know, you didn't have the only grandparents in Eastern Kentucky that cared for their grandkids and protected them and supported them. But not all of those kids made it out the way you did. And I don't want to give you an idea for your next book, but I'm just curious if in your book tours, anybody just didn't say to you, J.D., why you? How did you pull this off? What was it within you that makes this happen that just doesn't happen for everybody who had the same kind of loving grandparents you did?
Yeah, people definitely ask that. And I think part of the answer has to do with the fact that it wasn't just my grandparents, of course. Like you mentioned, my uncle, it was my aunt. It was, of course, my sister who, even though she was just a kid and a baby herself, really protected me from the very worst problems of our home and made sure that she served as a sort of filter, that anything that happened that was bad, it went through her first. So by the time it got to me, it wasn't as bad. So I think that, honestly, it's just that a lot of people who didn't necessarily have to play a positive role in my life decided to step up and do so. But part of it's probably just, you know, folks get lucky in their own way, right? The way that I think about it is that when you grow up in a pretty troubled home, you're fundamentally playing a game of statistical roulette. And some people, like my mom, lose that game of roulette and really struggle with it for their entire life. And some people, like me and my sister, find our way to overcome it and get above it. And I think that if you have the right people in your life, good mentors, good family, and so forth, you can increase the odds that you're going to come through it. But at the end of the day, you know, even kids of privilege end up struggling. Some kids of privilege end up struggling, and some kids who have lives that were much worse than mine don't struggle at all. So I think that there's something to be said for some people just get lucky, or if you believe like I do, some people get blessed, and we don't totally know why.
Well, it's just a remarkable story, and that raises another question. Who reads this book in your family? Did everybody read it? How about your mom? Did your mom read the book?
Yeah, everybody has read it, and, you know, it's a tough thing, of course, to talk about some of your family's most difficult times and periods in history, and to have that spread all over the world for people to read and criticize and think about. But I will say that one thing that helped is making my family part of the writing process. So I didn't just sort of sit down and conjure up these memories myself. I made sure that my aunt, my sister, my uncle, my mom had their say, that they read some of the drafts that I had produced and made sure that they felt things were fair and honest. And so I think that helped a lot. You know, it's always hard to have your dirtiest family secret put out there for the public to see. But when you involve your family in the writing process, it takes the edge off at least a little bit.
Well, as you point out in your book, your mother struggled with drug abuse for most of the time you're writing about. How's she doing now?
She's doing pretty good. Yeah. And those who have struggled with drug addiction know that it's, you know, you have your peaks and you have your valleys. There are the good times and the bad. And you just hope that you can spread out the good times as long as possible. And there's always that hope that when you're in a good time, that it's really going to stick, that somebody has really beat this thing for good. That's my hope for mom, and I'm really proud of her, proud that she's doing well right now. And like I said, I say a prayer every night that's how things keep on going. Of course, you recognize that when things do go bad, that it happens, and you just have to deal with those things as they come. But happy to say things are going well right now.
Great. So you talk in your book about those high school years that at the beginning of the high school years, it wasn't going too well until Mamaw took you in. Well, what happened in that household? What happened between you and Mamaw that made the difference, that produced the J.D. Vance that could head off to the Marine Corps, head back to Ohio State, get into Yale Law School of all places? Holy cow, that's quite an accomplishment.
Well, she was tough and she was hard on me, and I think I really needed that when I was a kid who was, you know, frankly not doing especially well in school, was slacking off a bit, not making the right decisions. And Mamaw really knew how to motivate me. You know, part of it is just that she was always on top of me. She really never skipped a beat. She never let me slack off, and that, of course, helped. But a lot of it is just that she was this incredibly powerful personality, as I try to convey in the book. You know, there was this moment where I started hanging out with this kid in my neighborhood who was, you know, not doing especially well, was one of the first kids to experiment with drugs, and I started smoking a little pot with him. And most parents, when they find out that their kid is hanging out with the so-called bad kid in the neighborhood, they try to convince their kids that they're not allowed to hang out with that person anymore, and their kids oftentimes don't listen. But I will never forget, Mamaw told me in her very Mamaw way that if I kept on hanging out with that kid, that she was going to run him over with her car and that no one would ever find out. And I don't think, looking back, that she would have ever harmed a 12 or 13-year-old kid, but I thought that she might when I was 12 or 13 years old. Exactly. And that was, of course, enough to change my behavior. So a lot of it was just that Mamaw was able to push my buttons in the right way and really encourage me to do the right things.
So what would have happened to J.D. Vance's life if he had, as I think you were considering upon leaving high school, gone straight to Ohio State instead of the Marine Corps?
Well, I don't think things would have turned out especially well for me. Being a good college student, living on your own, paying your bills on time, doing your homework when there's nobody telling you what to do, I think that actually requires a fair amount of independence and wisdom from young kids. And I just didn't have that at all. I didn't have that ability to live an independent life successfully. So if I had gone to Ohio State, I think what would have happened is that I would have incurred a lot of debt. I probably would have finished my education, but I wouldn't have gotten very good grades. And frankly, a lot of the opportunities that I've had since then would not have existed for me. A lot of those doors that opened wouldn't have opened for me because I would not have taken advantage of Ohio State in the way that I was able to 4 years later after a stint in the Marine Corps.
By the way, I noticed that you had an op-ed column in the New York Times on why Trump won the troops. This is a little bit of an aside, but maybe you could share with us, based on your own Marine Corps experience, how you feel that the military played into the role in the Trump election.
Well, I do think it's one of the underappreciated elements of Trump's election. If you look at the data, he did extraordinarily well among not just veterans and their families, but areas of the country where military service was very common. And in some ways, it's just a very concrete example of this cultural divide that has opened up between certain members of our society, where on the one hand, you have folks who, to their great credit, they revere the military, they respect the military, they support the troops. But on the other hand, you have a segment of the country that sees military service as something much more personal, as something they did themselves or something that their aunt, uncle, brother, or sister did. And I think that when you have such a personal connection to military service, it creates a certain cultural mindset that probably made it a lot easier for certain folks to vote for Donald Trump. I mean, that was certainly the case in the area of the country I came from, in southern Ohio.
I suppose you noticed that right next to your op-ed column in the New York Times was liberal economist Paul Krugman talking about how working class whites won the election for Trump. And he actually spends the last half of the column talking about Eastern Kentucky. Here he is, positioned on the New York Times right next to a real expert on Eastern Kentucky. And he says, and I'm going to quote this because it has something to do with something you talked about in the book: "The only way to make sense of what happened is to see the vote as an expression of, well, identity politics, some combination of white resentment at what voters see as favoritism toward non-whites, even though it isn't," that's what Krugman is saying, "and anger on the part of the less educated that liberal elites look down on them." I bring this up because you took a job when you were a kid at Dillman's, the local grocery store, and you spin that story off by suggesting why you think these folks who seem to have benefited so much over the years from Democratic policies and projects would leave the Democratic Party in such large numbers. Help our listeners understand that.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that comes from generous social welfare programs, and I'm not one of these people who think that we should let poor folks starve or struggle, but you see people who really need the help and who get the help and eventually find some way to obtain self-sufficiency, but you also see the people who really do abuse the system. And I think that of all people, those on the left should be very cognizant of the fact that when you see your neighbors, you know, not people of other races or other ethnicities, but people who look and think and talk just like you, when you see them abuse the system, it starts to make you wonder whether the system should exist in its current form. And so, you know, folks like Paul Krugman should really try to understand why it is that so many people who are poor, who are working class, who do benefit from this assistance in one way or the other, they think that it isn't working especially well. And I think there's a certain wisdom in recognizing that even though these programs are necessary, sometimes the way that they're administered can contribute to the very problems that they're meant to solve.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with J.D. Vance, author of a memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about schooling and the kind of schooling you had. You mentioned in your book that the state of Kentucky actually took over the schools in Jackson County. They were so bad. But you have a quote in here that I'd like to read, and you can comment on it. But I just think it's so interesting, an analysis of how we find a solution to the school problem. Our high school ranked near the bottom of Ohio's schools, but that had little to do with the staff and much to do with the students. The fault lies almost entirely with factors outside the government's control. That is such an interesting statement in light of the fact that every new administration that comes into Washington feels that it has to embark on something like No Children Left Behind or core curriculum or whatever it is, all out of Washington, when you seem to be saying that, you know, I really had some good teachers. It's the poverty, the drug abuse, all of the social conditions thrown together that make for such a difficult school, not necessarily the quality of the teachers. And teachers get beat up quite a bit these days in that regard. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think that's absolutely true. And while I think that it's important to think about the ways that we need to reform our schools and the ways that we need to give poor kids better opportunities, we also are doing ourselves a disservice if we ignore, you know, a very significant part of the challenge for a lot of these children. So just to give you a sense, I talk about this in the book, but when I was a kid, I went to school one morning thinking about the event that occurred that morning, right before I went to school, which was where my mom came into my mamaw's house and demanded that I provide her a jar of clean urine. And what ensued was a massive fight between me and my mom and my grandma about whether I should provide this urine. Of course, the stress and the moral deliberation about whether I should do it. And of course, the reason mom wanted it is because she had a urinalysis. She had a pee test that she needed to pass, and she knew that she wouldn't pass it on her own. So think about the kid who wakes up, spends the first 2 hours of the day in that situation, and then has to go to school and study and listen in class and pay attention and be a contributing member of the classroom. I think that if we ignore how common those experiences are among children like me when we're trying to reform our schools, we're just going to miss a huge chunk of the very real problem that's out there. And so, by all means, let's give parents better access to better schools, but let's also recognize when we're trying to make this problem better that a lot of the issues that exist in our poorest schools don't start at the institutions. They start in the homes of these kids who are really struggling to find some measure of stability or peace and quiet at home.
And when it comes to where to place that responsibility, as I read your book, I thought of a few years ago when Jesse Jackson and Bill Cosby, this was before, of course, he was discovered to be a sexual predator, both went on the circuit and publicly talked to the black community about the need to take responsibility for the disrepair in black families across America. And you do just about the same thing, don't you?
Well, I do. And I think it's important for folks to recognize, one, of course, that a lot of these areas have been hit hard by the decline of manufacturing jobs, by the decline of some of the local support networks that come from having stable, good work. But we've also got to recognize that there are other problems that are going on in these communities. And one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book was to just put in very personal terms, because I thought if I did that, it would be hard for folks to ignore the core argument that I was trying to make. But to really reveal to people what it's like to live in some of these communities and what the struggle is really like. And I think that if you appreciate the true nature of the problem, then you'll appreciate the fact that, you know, this has to be something that individual communities and individual people try to deal with, not just the government. I'm not saying the government doesn't have any role, but if we completely ignore the role that these communities have in creating the problem, but also in helping to solve the problem, then I think we're going to do a real disservice to kids like me who just want to have more opportunities and a better life, but don't necessarily know how to do it when they grow up like I did.
You had an experience when you worked, I believe, for a brief period with a senator in the Ohio State Legislature who was dealing with payday loans. And I thought it was a very good example of how government means well by stepping into a social situation such as existed in eastern Kentucky in your childhood, try to fix something. But as it turns out, they don't really understand how to fix it. Give us the example of that in your life as you learned it in Columbus and back in Kentucky.
Well, sure. Sure. So I was writing about how there was a payday lending ban that was on the floor in the Ohio Senate, and it eventually passed. And I should say that I don't have an opinion one way or the other on payday loans. I'm not enough of an expert on it to form an opinion. But what I was trying to highlight when I told that story is that the legislators who were talking about banning payday loans, they clearly didn't appreciate what role payday loans played either. And so I mentioned that, you know, I had written a check, but I had forgotten to deposit my paycheck in my bank account. So I was going to bounce this check, which of course comes along with overdraft fees and bounce check fees and so forth. And it was a payday loan that actually allowed me to make up that very temporary shortfall and, you know, enabled me to actually avoid those very significant fees, which would have been backbreaking to me when I was a college student at the time. And what occurred to me when the Ohio Senate was debating this bill is that nobody really understood the situations like that. Nobody really personally appreciated how someone could need a payday loan. And so I didn't think that they were approaching legislation and public policy on the topic with a full knowledge of how folks like me actually live. And so it's just an important example that whatever your politics and whether you think payday loans are a good thing or a bad thing, or whether that piece of legislation was good or bad, it's useful to remember that a lot of times legislators aren't always legislating with the full set of knowledge that they should have in mind.
Well, I have time for one more question, and I'm going to go up to stay in Columbus, Ohio for a minute. On your way to Yale Law School, you go through the Ohio State University. How long did it take you to get your undergraduate degree at Ohio State?
So I was at Ohio State for just 2 years, actually. So wasn't there for a very long time, but loved every second of it.
How'd you pull that off? That's where I'm going with this. I'm a university president, and I don't find many students who can get through their undergraduate studies in 2 years.
Well, it was a combination of a few things. So one, I had some credits from the Marine Corps training that I had that actually transferred over to Ohio State. So some elective physical education credits, things like that transferred. And, you know, the other thing is that I was able to take summer classes just because, you know, I was a full-time student and didn't have to go home for the summer. So I just stayed in Columbus and kept on taking classes. And then the third thing is that I just took a pretty heavy course load while I was there. So, you know, the combination of those three things made it possible for me to finish in 2 years. And of course, you know, I was most worried about the money. I was slowly incurring debt, even though I had the GI Bill. It didn't quite cover the full expense of my education. So I just wanted to get through so that I stopped burning through all that money.
J.D. Vance, it's been an incredible experience reading your book. And I've had the opportunity to tell so many people about it. And now to have the opportunity to talk with you, it's a real privilege on my part. I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciated it and enjoyed the talk.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with J.D. Vance. Next week, Beth Macy, author of True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping, and A Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.